Welcome to Modular March. I'm Andy, this is Robbie, and we are The Roll-Up.
Modular March is an educational experience about all things modular. Enjoy.
GM, welcome to Modular March. Today we have our special guest Alejo from Lumio. Alejo, welcome to Modular March.
Awesome, thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, welcome. Excited to learn about your thesis here about the way that crypto should be.
If people can see the slides now, proof of shit. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but we'll go into it why I'm relatively bullish or maybe conservatively bullish on proof of stake and why it's important to stay humble as we continue building, pushing the envelope on what's possible in decentralization and robust systems that will form the backbone of the financial infrastructure for the future. So yeah, excited to dive in here and, poke a little bit of fun at what we're doing and go into the work that, you know, hopefully will be adopted by millions, if not billions of people.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Cool. Yeah. So, you know, I've been a startup founder for a few years, but really my life goal is to be a stand-up comedian. Seems like getting a podcast and a Netflix special might make me rich before this crypto stuff. So just starting to hedge my career. And, you know, these slides and presentation is a good way to get up on a soapbox and, you know, try out some of these jokes. So kind of like bear with me as we go through them. Some of them land, some of them don't, but doing it on Zoom, I hear, is like the worst way to do it because you have no idea if there are people who are laughing or not, but hopefully Robbie and Andy's camera being off might give me a good idea. But yeah, how do we tell a story? What's the best way to tell a story? I think it's through memetics. Right now, you know, in this moment in time, at this point in history, we're going through a zeitgeist, a renaissance of memes, if you will. Doge, and I would argue Bitcoin was the first one to go through this, where a collective consciousness tapped into a moment that allowed us really to connect with each other and share ideas. So maybe broadly defining a meme as an idea, but very narrowly also as a mind virus. According to Richard Dawkins, the author of the book, The Selfish Gene, obviously a biologist, but one chapter focus very narrowly on this idea of memes being ideas that just self-replicate and spread around like viruses. They really don't care whether it's good or not for the host. They just spread around. And this is what we're seeing right now. And it's very interesting. The market's pricing them in at a very high value. I think at one point Pepe flipped Arbitrum, which is, you know, one of the major L2s on Ethereum, which, you know, maybe is a signal of exuberance, but maybe it's a signal of something else. And at the end of the day, I think our collective belief that something is worth something is what started this whole ordeal. That's what Satoshi's vision was. After we lost trust in the financial system after 2008, not really knowing how much money was out there, having rehypothecation of assets through derivatives indefinitely to the point where they just blew up and, you know, nobody really knew how or why. And, you know, we're still trying to pick up the pieces. We came up with this idea of Bitcoin, this collective social construct for money, which arguably, you know, all forms of money are. But how do we know that it's safe? How do we know that this stuff will live in perpetuity? According to Satoshi's vision, and, you know, Bitcoin kind of becomes a little bit like a religion. Part of my background, I've been, you know, following in Satoshi's vision for more than 10 years. And, you know, some people call us maxis or whatever. We're still building at the edge of innovation. We still want to push the envelope. We don't think it's all said and done. But the most important thing to think about is, how do we keep this stuff safe? How do we make sure that it actually can live on beyond us? That was Satoshi's vision. And, you know, we'll get into that in a little bit. And hopefully we can carry that on as we push the envelope on innovation and what's possible through these decentralized systems. So Ansem, who I would say is a modern day philosopher on X, posits here that the most dangerous part of making a lot of money is the ego that comes with it, right? And what is ego? Ego is just the thing that connects us to our humanity, to our own self-identity and consciousness. And in order to have ego death, we must tap into the collective consciousness, into all of humanity, without really thinking of ourselves. And the way that we can do this is through, again, tying it back to the idea of money, is the social construct for how do we exchange value on the internet. And, you know, this is something that hadn't really been done before, but Satoshi was able to implement it through proof of work. So this is my thesis on why I think memes are probably the only thing holding this thing together. Probably nothing else. If the meme dies, then probably Bitcoin and everything else dies. So it's important to keep the memes going, keep them pumping, if you will. And if not for that, it's at least fun that it's still around. So we'll go through a little bit of history on blockchain and memetics through blockchain. Proof of work was the first implementation of this, going back to 2008 or 2009, when Satoshi first published their white paper, essentially positing that physics or electricity could sustain a system of adversarial actors essentially coordinating to sustain a currency. Again, going back to the idea that money or currency is just a social construct that we agree has value and allows us to transact and collaborate with each other to build great things like, you know, computers and blockchains and whatnot. We must ask ourselves, like, what is actually securing the network? What's actually securing the blockchain? What is it our collective belief that it works? You know, if we go outside of crypto for a really long time, we had a collective belief that gold was valuable. Properties of hard money, like sure, fungibility and essentially finite supply, as precious metals have for gold, enabled us to share value in something that couldn't really just be inflated or be, you know, printed out. This is why seashells, for example, never really took off as money, but gold did. And not too long ago, around the 1970s, we had essentially a de-pegging of the gold standard, if you will, right? This was around the 1970s. And we're now going through one of the biggest experiments in humanity of just free-floating currencies. For thousands of years, we were, you know, essentially pegged to gold. And now we're just pegged to, I would argue, the U.S. dollar or the U.S. hegemony. So we'll kind of see how that works. But to Satoshi's vision, we must bring back those properties of hard money, of gold, of finite supply value that enables us to just transact with each other without any third party just inflating, you know, coming up with an infinite supply mint or an infinite supply hack button. So yeah, that brings us back to why Bitcoin is valuable. Initially, you know, it was worthless. Then it went to 100K pretty quickly within a few years. And, you know, then it hit a billion and now it's at a trillion. And our collective belief on why Bitcoin matters, I think, is partly what's holding it together. But what bootstrapped it really was the physics, the math, simple math, that it takes a certain amount of electricity, which translates into money. And that amount of electricity, which translates into money, should equal roughly the amount of coins or mining rewards or emissions that Bitcoin gives out. Perpetually, at least for 150 years or so more. And for whatever reason, that just stuck. And when you look at Bitcoin, actually a lot of numbers are arbitrary. So why 1 megabyte? Why 21 million? I really think he was just being relatively arbitrary, you know, pick the smallest number for megabyte, like a floppy disk isn't even a megabyte. You know, pick 21 million, the, you know, 42 million is, and the Hitchhiker's Guide is like the meaning of life. So why not break it in half? But that's all to say, like, this was just arbitrary, just kind of random. It doesn't really matter what we could have picked. It could have been Doge, for example, you know, started at a higher inflation schedule. But the idea is just, hey, we still need a collective belief that money is money and that we want to transact with each other. And that 21 million, again, is a meme. People argue, I think Jamie Dimon argued that, you know, Satoshi could just come back to life and make it, you know, 100 million if he wanted to. But us together as a collective consciousness controlling Bitcoin won't let that happen, right? The 21 million is now part of the meme. And, you know, if it ever forks, then that'll probably be Bitcoin Classic. Bitcoin will continue being 21 million. But it's important to remember that it was bootstrapped through physics. Again, electricity is what's sustaining the value in Bitcoin. And at least for the time being, again, I'm a little bit of a Bitcoin maxi. I think this is important to maintain because proof of stake, again, is a very experimental thing, just like free floating currencies are. And it might work out. I really hope that it does because we're betting a lot on Ethereum, but you know, it might not. And if it doesn't, then, you know, maybe we go back to Ethereum Classic or Bitcoin or whatever. The Bitcoin Renaissance is happening and L2s are coming up. So, you know, even if all the other stuff blows up, if Ethereum blows up, you know, we'll still have Bitcoin, hopefully.
I got a quick question because I've heard some people try to put a number on Bitcoin's value or try to rationalize Bitcoin's value and saying that it's a store of electricity and that's kind of what gives it its value. You know, I can see that, but it's still very different from something like a battery where there's literally like electricity in this container, and then you can use that to power your home or power your car. Like, do you believe in that thesis? Do you think there's some truth to that? If so, why? If not, why not?
Yeah, that's like a really good metaphor. I would say maybe a way to evolve that would be it's a store of security. And then that security, you literally have to expend electricity to secure it. So it's a monetary system, right? It's an internet of money, programmable money. But in the future, it could even be all these applications that are built on Ethereum. So then the question is, what's the cost of securing that? And the cost is literally electricity, which is, you know, pegged to oil, pegged to, I don't know, solar, whatever, right? And then Bitcoin's sole purpose is literally just to accrue more and more and more security, more and more and more electricity. And this is like controversial. So it might say, oh, you know, it's, you know, not good for the planet or whatever. But like, hey, if we really care about Bitcoin, if we really care about securing financial infrastructure or maybe like all the infrastructure for applications, maybe we'll figure out how to make Bitcoin more efficient. Maybe we'll figure out how to make renewables work so that, you know, we can continue powering Bitcoin. This sounds a little bit out there, but I think Bitcoin will probably enable us to build a Dyson sphere. So a Dyson sphere is essentially a way to mine the sun for electricity or power. And if you think about it, Bitcoin, the hardest part of a Dyson sphere would be sending the electricity, right? Like if you collect this, if you put a bunch of solar panels on satellites, like how do you send that electricity back to Earth? Like it'd be pretty hard, right? Maybe you could like, you know, bounce energy off the moon or whatever. But or you could just literally mine Bitcoin and then send money back to Earth. that's like a way to convert electricity into money. Again, money is like a way for us to collaborate. To answer your question specifically, I think it's a store of electricity, but that's more so a metaphor for security, right? Like it's expensive to bootstrap a bunch of electricity. Imagine if what was securing the Earth's financial infrastructure and applications was literally the Dyson sphere or the sun, right? That we're mining for the Earth. And, you know, if we think of Bitcoin in perpetuity, just accruing more and more security, more and more electricity, I think that's the eventual end goal. Or, you know, maybe there is some limit and Bitcoin doesn't work out, but, you know, that's all theoretical, I guess. Yeah, when you talk to Bitcoin maxis, it's kind of crazy because it's the most conservative one, but it's the one that as you extrapolate to 100, 200 years are like the only ones that are probably thinking that in that time horizon. So an interesting, you know, within Bitcoin circles, an interesting debate is like, will the miner fees be able to, like once you have no more inflation or emissions, will the miner fees be able to pay for the security or the miners? And like, to be honest, nobody freaking knows, right? Like it may or may not. And then at that point in time, like what happens? I guess nobody knows, but we could theorize and maybe run some experiments, maybe like run stuff on Litecoin or Doge, which are forks of Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean, that's all to say that Bitcoin is the most conservative and hopefully we continue to, you know, foster and develop it and really like respect it as the genesis of all of this. And you know, at the end of the day, we should be pushing the envelope, but keeping in mind that, you know, something like Bitcoin, where Satoshi's no longer around, there's no Bitcoin Foundation, you know, that's maintaining this stuff, that it is, I mean, it is like the backbone of this infrastructure. It's like, you know, the medium of exchange, the unit of account. Most people probably think in BTC more now than actual, you know, dollars. So yeah, we should continue to foster it and continue pushing innovation there. Yeah, so that transitions us into proof of stake. This is where the memes really come into play, because what is a meme? Again, going back to the idea, it's a collective belief in something. It's an idea. And if we all collectively believe that, you know, the US dollar or Bitcoin or whatever, Ethereum, holds value, then we should support it and we should develop it and we should have an inclusive community that continues growing. But what happens when that meme dies, right? What happens when the idea of religion dies, right? Christianity and I don't know, many other religions are in decline. And those are just memes. Those are just ideas that for a really long period of time replicated, but now are in decline. And, you know, obviously we're really early. This, you know, Jesus is still alive. Vitalik is still walking around. Maybe we still don't know who God is. Satoshi never really revealed themselves. But, you know, this religion that we now call crypto is led by real people. And it's a cultural project, as Alex Stokes here very, very sharply says. You know, we're just trying to figure out what to do as a community and carry this thing forward. And, you know, we're just using software to coordinate people. These are DAOs, these are blockchains. But at the end of the day, the culture or the community is the most important thing. If we all collectively stop believing in Ethereum, then there's nothing at stake, right? Like Ethereum loses value, it goes to zero. There's nothing securing Ethereum and it just all falls apart. So it's a, you know, thinly held house of cards, but as long as we all collectively strongly believe in Ethereum, then it should continue to work theoretically, right? And it's very important to note that Ethereum didn't get here on its own. It bootstrapped through proof of work, right? Not too long ago, we transitioned to proof of stake, and this was a huge milestone in the entire ecosystem. And without that bootstrapping phase, who would have known, right? Like maybe people didn't really believe in this. And proof of work as well has been hacked. You know, Ethereum Classic, let's not forget that Ethereum Classic, a bunch of people took, I think like cloud miners and, you know, 51% attacked Ethereum Classic. So all this stuff is still theoretical. There's papers out there about Ethereum's proof of work potentially being vulnerable to like 1/3 attacks. So if like 1/3 of validators were able to collude, or even, I think even a smaller number of that. So again, this is all still very experimental. That's all to say, you know, we should continue pushing the envelope. There's $200 billion at stake securing this network. But, you know, if anything goes wrong, I guess we still have Bitcoin or Ethereum Classic. Again, let's not forget that proof of stake is literally just proof of memes, right? Proof of shit coins. And until those memes, until that ETH, which is a meme, has a monetary premium, you know, your thing, which is secured by proof of stake, is probably not as safe as, you know, Ethereum. And this is why I think Eigenlayer has been super hyped up, because it's essentially just restaking or reusing the existing value that already has in the collective meme, the whole Ethereum community, which is sustaining the value of Ethereum. I think this is also why a lot of the L2s have been somewhat careful in transitioning to shared sequencers, where potentially they might need another coin to have essentially like another proof of stake layer on top of proof of stake. Because yeah, I mean, if you, there's some black swan event or we all just collectively, you know, lose faith in that thing, then that thing is no longer secure. So yeah, again, I think it's important to just, you know, stay humble, and we should continue pushing the innovation. I think if Ethereum was able to do it, I think others can also reach that escape velocity and become memes that secure networks through proof of stake. But we should stay humble and, you know, just remember where we came from and maybe not move too quickly, because there's a lot of money at stake in some of the stuff. Yeah, so next evolution of the meme is proof of time. Like, what the hell is Wi-Fi or whatever with? You know, again, we should respect these memes. Literally, yeah, Robinhood, one of the major brokerages in the US, they listed Solana, but shortly after listed WIF in less than a year. And that's freaking crazy. This means that literally this is breaking through the mainstream. The memes themselves are holding value. I think it wouldn't be impossible if like one of these meme coins like literally became bigger than the underlying layer one or layer two where it's living on. And then like the question then begets, like, what's safer? like being secured by the meme or being secured by the coin of the layer one, right? Like imagine theoretically speaking, WIF was worth more than Solana. Like, would you rather trust your Solana stake with WIF or Solana stake with Sol? I don't know, theoretical, maybe it never happens, but just how, given how crazy this market is, you know, who knows? But yeah, this is all just to say, like, you know, obviously, so we've been building on Aptos. We have the top AMM, the top wallet there. We definitely want to continue pushing the boundaries of innovation. I think blockchain is still relatively unusable. Ethereum layer one specifically and Bitcoin are boxing out a large portion of the population, like the 15, even like 15 cent gas fees, dollar gas fees, $14 gas fees, $100 gas fees, just like impossible to do any form of real transaction. Like imagine if you're paying for the bus and it's like, you know, 50 cents in your country and you have to pay with Bitcoin or something, like it's just not going to work. So we should definitely be pushing the boundaries. I think Solana has done a tremendous job of onboarding millions of people, probably tens of millions of maybe tens of millions of people at this point onto this speculation around memes, onto just speculation around cryptocurrency. And the fact that the user experience feels a lot like a Robinhood, right? You don't have to wait forever. Like Bitcoin, you literally have to wait 30 minutes to, you know, buy your NFT or, you know, send the transaction. Whereas on Solana, almost immediately, sometimes under a second, you're able to get confirmations. And the fees don't really, you know, are negligible. So this is definitely a huge incremental improvement in where we have. And again, don't get me wrong, we should respect this and continue to push Solana to become more like Ethereum. But again, we should be conservative in how we move forward. Things can break, you know. Solana definitely breaks all the time and it's kind of become a meme in itself. Even now it's like a little bit unusable. Things, you know, you're sending duplicate transactions. They don't have like a concept of a memory pool. That's, you know, architectural designs that at the beginning made sense, but now in production, maybe not. And we must remember, just like Bitcoin was made by people, so was Ethereum, so was Solana. And, you know, we'll hopefully continue iterating on it, improving it until it becomes a decentralized backbone for infrastructure, similar to Bitcoin, where Solana Foundation totally can move on, you know, and this thing can continue operating in perpetuity without us. Because the most important thing for money, I think, it's just having a credible neutral layer that anybody can trust, or, you know, trust that they don't have to trust anybody. But yeah, that, I believe that wraps up the session on memes. What I'll leave with is Satoshi's dead and so are you. You know, we're all going to die as founders of protocols, decentralized protocols. We're all going to die at some point. And the only way that this thing continues being alive is to keep that meme alive. So yeah, I think it's very important that these memes continue proliferating, not just Bitcoin and not just ETH, but also, you know, these cultural moments like WIF and Doge and Bonk and Dudu. And yeah, I think it just brings people collectively together to think about what's important. And if they sustain enough value, then they become a unit of account, medium of exchange, essentially money. And I think that was Satoshi's vision. So let's keep that vision alive. And yeah, just kind of how to tie this all into what we're building. We're trying to create a credibly neutral layer to deploy alternative VM applications onto Ethereum. We're also researching Bitcoin L2s, although they're really, you know, I would say far away from being production ready, maybe like several years. So focusing very narrowly on the virtual machine layer allows us to inherit the security, all the work essentially that's been done by teams like Arbitrum, Optimism, Polygon, ZK Zinc. And then just very narrowly focus on the virtual machine component so that teams that have built on Aptos, Solana, Sui, Cosmos can just copy paste their code and deploy onto essentially the places where so far has shown to have a Lindy effect of security, liquidity, and applications building. So the benefit of this is that you'll be able to, as an example, we built, again, one of the top applications on Aptos. We can just copy paste their code, deploy onto Optimism, deploy onto Arbitrum, have ETH native liquidity, have composability with Base, have composability with OP mainnet, and share liquidity, a shared bridge that's validated through the prod proofs that maintain Optimism. And, you know, it's very, very hard to do an L2. You know, a lot of twos are proliferating, and I'm sure if you talk to those teams, they, you know, some of them will tell you that it's very, very hard. And even the major L2s that have been working around for a long time are still not there. We still have permission fraud proofs, for example. That's not to say that this is not maturing. And very, very soon, I believe in this year, We're going to have permissionless fraud proofs. We're going to have shared sequencers. And then again, the vision of a decentralized, credibly neutral layer that nobody has to trust because it's trustless will start to come to light. And we just want to leave our mark in Ethereum's infinite garden by allowing anyone with any virtual machine with any language to just deploy onto where they want to deploy. Here are just some comparisons of what you can. And the basic architecture is just deploying any virtual machine onto these existing L2s where there's already a Lindy effect of security, liquidity, and composability. Just a little bit of background from us. We've started building applications with the Libra Diem technology even before Aptos and Sui were around. So very familiar with the Move tech, very bullish on it. It's essentially Sam Blackshear, who is literally a computer linguist PhD, took the design implementations of Rust, the resource and the static type, and made a framework essentially for blockchain applications or smart contracts. So very, very clever. Took the best of Solidity and Rust and just made it into this, baby that has a native prover built in, so you don't have to use like third-party libraries. Although, in Ethereum, you can definitely do formal verification, but you have to pull in native prover, has like native upgradability. So it's just like just feels right. Just like, driving in a Bugatti versus a gently used 2001 Honda Civic, which Ethereum sometimes feels like. We've been building when Facebook first came out with this technology. We thought this is the next big thing. If you remember, Diem was first permissionless, then it became permission as regulators were like, wait, you're good trying to make the world's money. We wanted to make the Move virtual machine permissionless. We experimented with the Substrate framework for Polkadot, the Cosmos framework, just to be able to deploy. If the L2 frameworks like the OP stack were mature enough back then, when we started building this, we probably would have started there. But just now they're starting to get to the maturity level where the L2s are going to look a lot like Cosmos and Polkadot. That was the vision and has been the vision for a long time. So, a lot of the work that we did is now very applicable to what we're doing now. And again, enabling the virtual machine component and these modular application stacks that enable you to build with really, choose your VM, choose your data availability layer, even like choose your own settlement layer. We worked with that as Aptos and Sui evolved from the Diem project. They each raised $400 million. We transitioned to building out infrastructure on top of Aptos. So we built out the top wallet, the top AMM, and Aptos, I think, will continue to grow. I think right now, as Solana is being stress tested, a lot of the kinks are coming out where people are like, okay, maybe the UX isn't perfect. Maybe pessimistic concurrency is not as great as optimistic concurrency. For the viewers, pessimistic concurrency means you need to select the memory that you're going to action on. So you need to lock that memory. Whereas optimistic concurrency, you don't have to lock that memory. So you get better user experience, some performance, like some people report on Solana, things taking several seconds, for example. The memory pool, they just inherited, again, conservatively from Ethereum, still having a fee market and memory pool. So some of the issues we're seeing now of like duplicate transactions don't happen as much. So yeah, I think Aptos and Sui definitely made iterative improvements over Solana, kind of like the next generation of blockchains. And, I think they still have potential. Theoretically, even as like we expect millions, if not billions of people to come, 30,000, 100,000 transactions per second are not going to be able to maintain, concurrently millions or billions of users. So I think it's important to have, diversity in this. And, we're still bullish on Aptos. However, we want to go back to our grassroots. My values and principles are alongside decentralization and following Satoshi's vision. So this is why we're building Lumio, a conservative way to deploy alternative VM applications from Aptos, Solana, onto Ethereum. And yeah, excited to bring it into market. We're on testing it now with the Move implementation. We're going to be able to get to mainnet pretty soon, and start to show the world that you don't need to be vendor locked into the EVM on Ethereum.
How does that native prover how does the native upgradability of Move, how do you reconcile the upgradability with the decentralization and the censorship resistance that is so important?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, People should be aware that upgradability is essentially backdoors into DeFi protocols. I think Serum is the best example of this on Solana. When nobody knew who had the upgrade keys to Serum, everybody freaked out and they're like, oh my God, like who the hell has access to the money? So yes, upgradability is definitely very, 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 can be very, very, very risky, but it's still useful in integrations. For example, if you're building like trading bots or, you know, even if you're going towards gradual decentralization, you can have upgradability. Hopefully people will, you know, eventually, you know, migrate to immutable, but, you know, it has its trade-offs. Immutable, you know, if you fuck things up, like there's literally no going back. So yeah, I mean, definitely, it's a trade-off. For example, Liquid Swap is deployed immutably, and you do have that choice when you deploy the contract to do it immutably or to have it be upgradable. For integrations, for example, for trading bots, you know, market makers, et cetera, a lot of that stuff is still smart contracts and, you know, it's still fairly centralized and people want to be able to upgrade their code relatively easily. On Ethereum, what that looks like is through proxy contracts, which just feels very janky and it's like kind of hard to manage and look at and inspect. So just having it be built in is like pretty nice. Just feels good.
Gotcha. I'm curious what kind of decisions you might make differently than other teams who aren't so, let's say, like libertarian or like so deeply rooted in the ethos of crypto. Like, it doesn't have to be a direct example, but like what have you seen? Like there's the angle that you're coming out, and there's like different types of builders in the space. Like how does your ethos impact your decision making? And yeah, just curious more about that.
Yeah, I think it's a trade-off because we're not able to move as quickly and offer the performance improvements that a lot of this cutting-edge technology has. So we might be foregoing, for example, using a new data availability layer that enables faster, cheaper transactions for something maybe like, I don't know, ETH L1 for a period of time, then maybe like Eigen, right? And I think that comes with trade-offs because you could be able to offer a better user experience, but then the trade-off might be liveness. For example, if the data availability layer goes down, then that's going to impact, you know, the user experience during those points of downtime. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a trade-off. I would say the most conservative we want to be is at the settlement layer. And I would love to experiment at the sequencer, maybe like execution layer. Like I think this is a meta that I'm not sure hasn't taken off yet, but I think should. I think Near is kind of pioneering this, but using alternative L1s that already have, you know, value and at stake securing blockchains to use for data availability sequencing. Rome is an example of a project that's, you know, aiming to use Solana for decentralized sequencing. And the sequencer component is already like a socially acceptable centralized component, right? Right now, they're all centralized sequencers. So if you were to just bootstrap that, you know, through the security of existing L1s, I think that's like a good trade-off. So I'd say I'm more of like a settlement maxi, you know, I think there's definitely trade-offs that you can make. But yeah, I mean, I think there's value in building conservatively in crypto because, you know, you could hope that nothing goes wrong, and if nothing goes wrong, that's awesome. But when things go wrong, it fucking sucks and there's like no going back.
Yeah. So for you guys though, if you're going to use Ethereum for data availability or Eigen at some point or other, depending on your decision, the user experience and the fast execution, that all happens with the move VM, right? Like that's kind of where that comes from.
So it's all dependent. So the move virtual machine can enable parallelized transaction execution, but you're still dependent on Ethereum layer one or your data availability layer for costs, for example. Yeah. So it definitely impacts certain components, but it's not the all end all be all. Like for example, you know, move has this native prover built in, but you can also do formal verification with EVM. I think and similarly, you know, you can do parallelized transaction execution natively, but you can also do block STM on EVM and still have parallelized transaction execution with EVM. So I think at the end, the virtual machine is relatively commoditized in terms of like the end user experience. I think more importantly for the user experience, I think data availability is probably more important. But what this enables is just the diversity of developers being able to just build with whatever language they want, not having to maintain like all these different code bases across these different networks as well. And yeah, I mean, you should just have diversity. It's probably not good to put all our eggs in one basket onto the EVM. So, you know, theoretically there could be some, you know, exploit or bug that we haven't yet figured out. Like I forgot what it's called, the opcode that was like suicide or something like that. That's like, what the hell? Why is this thing even here? I think they're getting rid of it or something. Right. But yeah, I mean, I think generally we just want diversity. I think there's always trade-offs and, you know, no thing I think will be like a killer, you know, killer thing. There's always going to, hopefully we continue to have diversity in the implementation. So still bullish on Solana VM, for example, still bullish on EVM, still bullish on all the data availability. And to answer your previous question, we're also dependent on the ecosystems we're deploying. So Optimism, for example, is likely going to be L1 for data availability for a period of time until it's safe enough to use these other ones. So, you know, we don't have to maintain those components. We just benefit from the upgrades that they make. But then again, the trade-off is that, you know, maybe we're not able to explore and push the boundaries as, you know, other, you know, isolated L2s might be able to.
Yeah. When it comes to the modular stack, the modular kind of thesis, what is the thing that excites you currently the most of this concept?
Yeah, I think it's the ability to just have diversity in how you choose the tech stack. I think, again, putting all your eggs in one basket onto just the EVM, just the Move, just the Solana VM might be, you know, not the best thing long term. Similarly, on data availability, like you want redundancy in the data availability, right? Like if one of these goes down, you want to be able to, you know, have the others. So I think it's the diversity that it brings to the tech stack. Like I think it would probably, like innovation would probably become overly stagnant as it has on Bitcoin, for example, to kind of bring it back. Whereas with modularity, we're able to test all these ideas, put them to the test in production. And then, you know, maybe naturally the market kind of coalesces towards a shelling point. Then you also have this diversity that, you know, continues to foster more innovation, continues to foster and push, you know, the edge and boundaries of what's possible.
What is your thesis on the end result of L2s? Like recently we heard Hart from Across and Uma. His thesis is that there's going to be a handful of winners take most. Yep. Maybe thousands of app chains and app-specific rollups, but a handful of general purpose ones. How do you feel about that? And how does that affect your thinking? Or what is your thesis?
Yeah, I think that's very much aligned with how we're thinking about it. These technologies. So if we look at, for example, search engines, or we look at, you know, chips, it's a network effect. And the power law distribution of this network effect is that the sum of the tail equals, I think it's like half of the big one. And we're seeing this literally in the price of Bitcoin, where like the sum of all the other coins equals, you know, all of Bitcoin. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think similarly here, you'll get, but that's not to say like the, you know, the Google, you know, could be surpassed or whatever. So like Solana very easily overtake Ethereum, but maybe Bitcoin, you know, stays as the number one, et cetera. So very similarly here, I think we will probably have, you know, kind of like an aggregation or, you know, a conglomeration of the top ones that people trust the most, that has the most network effects around composability. And then there'll be aggregation layers like the shared sequencer, maybe validity proofs that enables just the user experience to feel more like a monolithic chain, where you have shared security, shared liquidity, composability. And then, you know, kind of have like these bubbles around Ethereum, and maybe like rely on bridges or other forms of like connecting value. But yeah, I that kind of aligns with my vision too. I think you'll probably have a power law distribution of L2s, and that's why we're also betting on integrating into the existing ones as opposed to trying to bootstrap. One analogy, Dovey posted this, essentially she said that L2s are like cities, and you know, they have their own communities, their own cultures. So carrying on that analogy, I think Arbitrum Optimism are like San Francisco and New York, you know, early cities, like very cool people, very smart people congregating there, great ideas. Whereas, you know, the undertaking of starting a new L2 is kind of like, okay, let's go and bootstrap a new city in like, you know, the middle of the country or something. And like, I think that's, you know, it could definitely play out. You could be the next Denver or whatever, but it could very easily, you know, be hard to bootstrap or compete against, you know, the coastal cities.
Good take. Well, Alejo, thanks for coming on Modular March, and
giving this presentation definitely a unique one. And it's kind of good to have a refresher on like why we're even here in the first place. You kind of get lost in the sauce a bit.
Yeah.
So appreciate that.
Amazing. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having us and me, and thank you for the opportunity.
Cheers.